We were speaking yesterday about the first century, and in connection with that, we looked at Numbers at C, the period of little evidence, we call it. And then under number 5, we were beginning to look at information from non-Christian sources, of which the small a was Josephus, and Josephus records a little information that is of interest in connection with the book of Acts. And there's one paragraph about Christ, if we notice, which really doesn't come under church history, but more with the gospel history or apostolic history. And then a small b there is Suetonius on Claudius. Suetonius on Claudius. Suetonius was a Roman writer who was born after the time when Claudius reigned. So everything that he writes about Claudius is gained from other sources. But we have already noticed in connection with Claudius how Suetonius said that the Jews stirred up by Christ, or Crestus if you want to take it so, but nobody knows what it means, if it doesn't mean Christ, were unruly, and Claudius ordered that they be expelled from Rome. And this is perhaps the earliest reference in a pagan writer to anything connected with Christ or Christianity. Well, it says so little that you really can't draw anything from it much. That we know the suggestion made that it means that there was some agitation among the Jews about Christianity, and that this agitation or disturbance led to Claudius simply saying, put them all out of the room. But it was not enforced very long. At least we find them there very soon after that time. But then small c is Tacitus and Suetonius on Nero. Tacitus and Suetonius on Nero. And here we have evidence from pagan sources on the first Roman persecution of Christianity of which we know anything. Suetonius, who was not born until 75 A.D., when Vespasian was already emperor, wrote his book 40 or 50, well, maybe 60 years after the time of Claudius, maybe 50 years after the time of Nero. But among the, one of the books Suetonius wrote was called Lives of the Caesars, and he wrote a life of Nero. And in his life of Nero, he makes a reference to the Christians. He says in his life of Nero, in his reign, many abuses were severely punished and repressed, and as many new laws were instituted, a limit was set to expenditure, the public banquets were reduced to gifts of food, the sale of cooked food in taverns was forbidden, except for vegetables and greens, whereas formerly every kind of delicacy was offered. Punishment was inflicted on the Christians, a set of men adhering to a novel and mischievous superstition. He put a stop to the pranks of the charioteers who, from long immunity, had assumed the right of ranging at large and cheating and robbing for amusement. The pantomimes and their companies were banished. Now, this is a summary he makes of Nero's activities, of those activities of Nero's that he evidently thought were good. And so we find that sometime between 100 and 160 A.D., approximately 100 years after the crucifixion of Christ, here is a man, a Roman, writing a life of the Caesars, in which all he seems to know about the Christians is that Nero had punished them and that they were a set of men adhering to a novel and mischievous superstition. Well, now this is, does not tell us very much, actually. It seems strange that a man who was writing a history would not know more about the Christians by the time of 100 years after Christ. And yet it's not so strange when we realize that there are probably people within a mile of here who've never heard of Faith Seminary. I remember we had much excitement over here in New Jersey 30 years ago when on account of Dr. McIntyre's membership in the independent board for Presbyterian Foreign Missions, action was taken against him in the USA Presbyterian Church. And at that time, he, with a number of others of us, left that church. And he walked out, and they worshipped in a tent for a while, and then they built a tabernacle. He had a church of well over 1,000 people. 10 years went by, and we, of course, were very familiar with his work, and there were references to it in the newspapers, and we felt as if you'd think everyone in the country knew about it. And then, about 10 years after it had been, his new church had been founded, and this tabernacle built, and there were over 1,000 people worshiping there every Sunday, some people came over to see him, and they said they came from a little church in Merchantown, 4 miles away from his church, and they had had some difficulties in the church and decided they didn't want to be independent anymore, but to get tied up to a good evangelical group that would give them guidance and help, and somebody recommended they get in touch with him, and they'd never heard of him and never heard of his church, and they were just 4 miles away. Well, I was quite impressed. I heard that to show how we can know a great deal about something and people 3 or 4 miles away can know nothing about it at all. And so there doubtless are many people in Philadelphia who have never heard of Bay Seminary. There may be many people in Philadelphia who've never heard either the word Presbyterian or Baptist, either one of them. It's amazing how those of us in certain circles hear a great deal about certain things, and those in other circles never hear anything about it. I know in at least a third of the people of Philadelphia are Roman Catholics, and there are great controversies that rage in the Roman Catholic Church, of which most of the people are thoroughly familiar, which those of us outside of Christ would never hear anything about, unless a little something happens to get in the newspaper. So the fact that Suetonius, 100 years after the death of Christ, knows so little about Christians as merely to describe them as a set of men adhering to a novel and mischievous superstition does not prove that there were not a great many people in the Roman Empire who knew a great deal about them. And yet it does also show that there were a good many people, including some who, like Suetonius, were interested in getting information and seeking out what situations were and what was happening, who knew practically nothing about them. And it shows us how slowly, in a way, Christianity spread. It spread in one way very rapidly. Within 40 years after the death of Christ, there were Christians in almost every part of the empire. But it spread in a way slowly, in that in almost every part of the empire, there probably were thousands of people who had never heard of it at all, and even 100 years after the death of Christ. We get much more information, however, about the activities of the Christians in the time of Nero from another writer named Tacitus. Tacitus, Suetonius is not considered a particularly good writer, though his information is of great interest, but some regard Tacitus as one of the great historical writers of all history. And Tacitus wrote a series of annals claiming to describe the history of Rome from the earliest times right up to the time of Tacitus. He died in 120 A.D. was born 15 years before Suetonius and died 40 years before Suetonius died. And at about 100 A.D., thus you see at least 30 years, maybe 40 years after Nero's time, Tacitus, in his Annals of the Roman Empire, describes the relation of Nero to the Christians. Now, in these Annals of Tacitus, by the way, the great bulk of them has been lost. We haven't more than a fourth of all the Tacitus wrote. But we're very fortunate in having been preserved the part that was nearest to his day, which would be the part in which his information would probably be most accurate, isn't it? But it's interesting to see what he says about them. He tells how Rome burned, and then how there was a rumor which began to spread, which blamed Nero for it, and many people suspected Nero had set fire to the city. And then Tacitus continues, but all the endeavors of men, all the emperor's largesse, and the propitiation to the gods did not suffice to allay the scandal or banish the belief that the fire had been ordered by Nero. And so to get rid of this rumor, Nero set up as the culprit and punished with the utmost refinement of cruelty a class hated for their abomination, who are commonly called Christians. Christus, from whom their name is derived, was executed at the hands of the procurator Pontius Pilate in the reign of Tiberius. Checked for the moment, this pernicious superstition again broke out. not only in Judea, the source of the evil, but even in Rome, that receptacle for everything that is sordid and degrading from every quarter of the globe, which there finds a follower. Accordingly, arrest was first made of those who confessed to being Christians. Then on their evidence, an immense multitude was convicted, not so much on the charge of arson as because of hatred of the human race. Besides being put to death, they were made to serve as objects of amusement. They were clad in the hides of beasts and set and torn to death by dogs. Others were crucified. Others set on fire to serve to illuminate the night when daylight failed. Nero had thrown open his gardens for the display and was putting on a show in the circus, where he mingled with the people in the dress of a charioteer or drove about in his chariot. All this gave rise to a feeling of pity, even towards men whose guilt merited the most exemplary punishment. For it was felt that they were being destroyed, not for the public good, but to gratify the cruelty of an individual. Now this is very interesting, as the attitude of a cultured Roman of 40 years after the time of Nero. It shows what little he knew about the Christians. The rumors were being spread about them, accusing them of all sorts of crimes and of all sorts of attitudes, and the people tended to believe these rumors. It's terrible how the spreading of rumors can do tremendous harm to any individual or group, and you never can catch up with the rumors, with a denial of them. And rumors were spread against the Christians. But it would look from it as if when Nero so treated the Christians, the Roman people felt, well, they deserve it. These wicked people, these queer, strange fanatics, they deserve it. But they don't deserve it for having set fire to the city. We don't believe they did set fire to it. But they deserve it in general. So there was great sympathy for the Christians, but no desire to make a stand to try to stop it or to protect them or to help them. However, as you can well imagine, this sympathy that it would arouse for the Christians would mean that when the persecution was over, there would be some who could be more easily approached than they could have otherwise, and would be more ready to listen to a picture of what the Christians really were. But here this is nearly 100 years after the death of Christ, not quite as late as the time of Suetonius, but getting nearer, when this was all that Tacitus knew about the Christians. And all that we know, incidentally, about Nero's persecution is contained in these two statements. That is to say, we have statements by Eusebius in his history about the persecution, but Eusebius wrote 200 years after this. And how much would any one of you know if you were to try to write a history of what happened here in Pennsylvania 300 years ago? You couldn't find anybody who could tell you from first-hand observation of anything that happened then. You would have to look for books or records. And Eusebius had to look for books and records, and we have no reason to think that he had any source to which to go except these statements of Tacitus and Suetonius. However, Tacitus' statement is certainly full enough and explicit enough to show that Nero did torture the Christians and kill them in many very cruel ways. And even though many of the people felt a sympathy for the Christians, thinking that they hadn't actually set the fire and they didn't deserve this, yet this tarnished their name and it established an attitude on the part of the empire toward the Christians. Now, that was we're under number 5, information from non-Christian sources. I called A. Josephus under that small, A. B. Suetonius on Claudius, C. Tacitus and Suetonius on Nero, and 5 is Domitian's persecution. Now, you all know that Domitian was the emperor who was killed in 96 A.D., so he is about 30 years after Nero, yes?
Yes.
Five was information from non-Christian sources, and under that I had a small A, Josephus, a small B, Suetonius on Claudius, and a small C, Suetonius and Tacitus on Nero. And then that was C, and then D was Domitian's persecution. Domitian's persecution. And Domitian, as you know, was the emperor who the last of the Flavian line. And we have a couple of statements about prominent Roman individuals, men or women of high family in Rome who were sent into exile by Domitian or who had their goods confiscated or something like that and were accused of superstition. We have no specific, absolute evidence that Domitian persecuted Christians. But by the time of Eusebius, it was generally believed that these prominent people in Domitian Empire who were persecuted on account of being Christians. So it is generally considered that the second persecuting empire emperor was Domitian. Now this is most probable, but not certain. We know that Nero persecuted Christians, and he's the first Roman emperor of whom we know that. And we know that the reason Nero did it was not because of any desire per se to destroy Christianity, but it would seem to be an excuse to turn popular feeling away from being against himself and people from thinking that he burned Rome. But he did it with most terrible cruelty. And of course, all that ended when Nero was killed. And it was principally in Rome, though there was a certain amount of it in other cities. Now, under Domitian, there does not seem, as far as we have evidence, to have been any general persecution of Christians. But it would seem that certain prominent individuals were persecuted, and perhaps on account of being Christians, although from what we know of Domitian, he seems to have been a very suspicious and jealous sort of individual who was always afraid there was a conspiracy against him, and he did bring charges of various types against prominent individuals who he feared might be trying to interfere with his power. And so that we really know very, very little about this persecution under Domitian. But the fact that people later on would think that Domitian had done it on account of people being Christian, whether that's true or false, leads somewhat to the suggestion that it might have strengthened a general feeling among Roman officialdom that Christianity was in some way something that was against the state and that should not be permitted in the country. Now, you see how little, then, we know about the spread of Christianity during the first century. We know a great deal from the book of Acts. But aside from that, we know very, very little. So we have looked at every scrap of evidence that we have, either from the first century or from the next few years writing about the first century, telling us about the spread of Christianity. And if that's all we knew, you might almost think, well, it probably died out about the end of the first century, the beginning of the ninth, and nothing ever came of it. But when we get into the second century, we find evidence that that was not what happened. So we take Roman numeral 3, the church in the second century. The church in the second century. And under that, just as background, capital A, the Roman emperors. I've spoken in general about it already. Just for purposes of reference, I will give you the name of the emperors during this period and tell you a little bit about them. Number one is Nerva. 96 to 98. Now, properly, you see, he isn't in the second century, he's in the first. But at the death of Domitian, the Flavian line came to an end, and we have a whole new type of government, actually, which continued for approximately a century. So I include Nerva here. He only reigned 2 years. He was a senator who was put in Domitian's place, a man of high character, well thought of. And actually, he is, in a way, one of the most important men in all history because of what he did. He introduced a new system. And the new excellent system which he introduced lasted for a century. And Gibbon, who many think is one of the greatest writers of history that ever lived, in his history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire stated, he personally would rather have lived in the second century AD than any other century in all history. He was writing about 200 years ago, I guess, not more than 200 years ago. But Gibbon wrote that way and thought so highly of that period because it was a period in general of law and order, of peace and personal individual freedom. And this was due to quite an extent to the system Nerva introduced. Now, no one could have introduced the whole system, The system rested back on years of development of a very fine system of government, the government of the Roman Republic, which was taken over by the Roman Empire. But Nerva introduced, as we've already mentioned, the idea of having the emperor look about and pick out the best man he could find to succeed him. And in general, this seems a much better way to pick a leader for a nation than to have men travel all over the country giving big speeches, knocking one another, and trying to see which one is most photogenic and who therefore can get the most votes. But as long as we live in an imperfect world, we won't have any perfect system. And I know of no other time in the history of the world when this particular system was used and used effectively, and it lasted a century in Rome and then came to an end. But during that century, it provided a continuous government of a pretty high standard for the whole Roman Empire, with peace and mobility, freedom to go from one part of the empire to another and carry on business or spread ideas, so long as one did not put himself in a position where he was considered a menace to the continuance of the power of the Roman Empire and to the stability which it established. But Nerva selected this very fine general named Trajan, and Trajan reigned from 98 to 117. And Trajan carried on the excellent system of government which had developed under the Roman Republic, but which had been further developed by the better emperors of the previous century. And Trajan was in general such a high character, T-R-A-J-A-N. He was in general such a fine character that one of the early popes, a man of a higher quality than a great many of them, reading about Trajan once, was so impressed with his character that he prayed that Trajan might be admitted to heaven and believed that his prayers were answered. Now, we have no evidence that Trajan knew anything about Christ, but as a pagan, he was, doubtless, a man of very high character. Mr. Jensen, do you have a question? Now, Trajan selected Hadrian, H-A-D-R-I-A-N, and for 17 years, no, it's 21 years. For 21 years, from 117 to 138, Trajan reigned, carrying on along the lines of Hadrian's reign. Hadrian traveled constantly throughout the empire and was constantly looking for ways of improving the government and administration. And then Hadrian selected a man of high quality to succeed himself who was called Antoninus Pius. And for some reason, after him, the whole group of them is called the Antonines. I don't know why his name, instead of the first one, should be given to the whole group, but that is what is done historically. Antoninus Pius was emperor from 138 to 161. And then he was succeeded by Marcus Aurelius. Marcus, M-A-R-C-U-S, Aurelius, A-U-R-E-L-I-U-S, 161 to 180. And when I was a boy, I remember my father reading the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. He was a Stoic. He was a philosopher who is considered to have held very high ethical ideals, and is usually considered one of the finest of the Roman emperors, one of the best characters among them. But unfortunately for him, his times were more difficult than under the previous rulers. Enemies were pressing in on the borders of the empire. There was a great famine. A great depression occurred. He had a great deal of misfortune, that is, to the empire as a whole during his reign. And I cannot forgive him for having broken the chain that Nerva had begun. Because instead of picking out a first-class man to succeed himself, he allowed it to go into the old and worthless hereditary system of having his son Commodus, his worthless son Commodus, succeed him. And so Commodus, C-O-M-M-O-D-U-S, reigned from 180 to 193. And Commodus was such a worthless character that after 13 years of him, they could stand him no longer. They killed him, and an African general succeeded him, who was named Septimius Severus, S-E-P-T-I-M-I-U-S, Severus. He began to reign in 193 and went on into the next century. And with him begins a whole new period, because the Antonine period comes to an end And now you have the period when most emperors reign only a brief time and are killed or removed and someone else put in their place. Yes? Began in 193, and I didn't give the date to the end, that gets beyond our present century. And now, capital B here is, I will call Pliny, P-L-I-N-Y, apostrophe S, Pliny's correspondence with Trajan. Pliny's correspondence with Trajan, which was about 110 A.D. And in view of the very, very little that we know about Christianity during the, aside from the book of Acts and the epistles, during the whole century after the death of Christ, this Pliny's correspondence with Trajan assumes very great importance because it is our first clear evidence of the way that Christianity was spreading. And it also is our first clear evidence of what had become the official Roman attitude towards Christianity. All we know about the attitude of the emperors towards Christianity previously is contained in the brief quotations I've given you. But now we have a very some very interesting evidence, and evidence particularly on these two points. And so I will read you the letter that Pliny wrote to Trajan and Trajan's answer. Pliny, by the way, was a Roman, a man of great culture, interest in many fields of learning, whom Trajan appointed as governor of a section of Asia Minor called Bithynia. And there in Bithynia, a section of Asia Minor, Pliny was trying to be a good governor, to rule the people with fairness and with justice, and to maintain the administration of law and order in a proper way, and his good friend Trajan, who was emperor, was receiving reports from him, and the two were on friendly enough terms that there was nothing formal about the reports, but instead Pliny was asking Trajan's advice on matters and telling him fully what he saw and what experiences he had. And so it is extremely interesting to see what Pliny wrote to Trajan, and to see what Trajan answered, particularly for the evidence that it throws on these two points, the spread of Christianity and the official Roman attitude towards Christianity. Thus far, we have no evidence of the official Roman attitude towards Christianity. You remember that in the book of Acts, the Roman officials tried to maintain order and to quite an extent serve as protectors of Christians against attempts to interfere with them. There are two or three instances of that in the book of Acts. And we have the evidence about Claudius, but we don't know enough about it to know that he's even heard of Christianity. And as far as Nero is concerned, we have no evidence that Nero had any direct idea about Christianity. He seems just to have been looking for a scapegoat. And as far as Domitian is concerned, he wanted to protect his position as emperor from any conspiracies, and he suspected almost everybody being a conspirator. And so whether Christianity entered into his attitude towards these men, we don't know. But now we have this very interesting letter. And in the course of letter 96 from Pliny to Trajan, Pliny says, "It is my custom, my lord, to refer to you all questions about which I have doubts. Who indeed can better direct me in hesitation or enlighten me in ignorance? In the examination of Christians, I have never taken part. Therefore, I do not know what crime is usually punished or investigated, or to what extent. So I have no little uncertainty whether there's any distinction of age, or whether the weaker offenders fare in no respect otherwise than the stronger, whether pardon is granted on repentance, or whether when one has been a Christian is no gain for him in that he has ceased to be a Christian. Whether the mere name, if it is without crime, or crimes connected with the saints are punished. Meanwhile, I've taken this course with those who were accused before me as Christians." So evidently he understood it was a crime to be a Christian, but he evidently didn't know why, or how much, or just what was wrong. So that attitude, which seems to have become adopted by the leaders of the Roman Empire and their governors as a result of the persecution under Nero and under Domitian, We don't know what's wrong with Christianity, but it's illegal. And of course, the fact was that Judaism was permitted as the religion of a nation. But Christianity was a new religion that had arisen. It had no right of existence granted it by the empire they had granted to the Jewish religion when they conquered the Jews. It had no right to exist from the Roman Empire, and the Romans looked upon it with suspicion. But Pliny had the impression they looked upon it more than that. They looked upon it as a crime. But he doesn't know just why, or whether just to be a Christian is a crime, or whether to do crimes that Christianity leads to is necessary. So he says, meanwhile, I've taken this course with those who were accused before me as Christians. I've asked them whether they were Christians. Those who confess, I asked a second and a third time, threatening punishment. Those who persisted, I ordered led away to execution. So he understood it was a capital crime, but he didn't know why. But that's what he did, but he's asking Christians, what should I do about it? He says, for I did not doubt that whatever it was they admitted, obstinacy and unbending perversity certainly deserved to be punished. There were others of the like insanity, but because they were Roman citizens, I noted them down to be sent to Rome. Soon after this, as it often happens, because the matter was taken notice of, the crime became widespread and many cases arose. An unsigned paper was presented containing the names of many. But these denied that they were or had been Christians, and I thought it right to let them go, since at my dictation they prayed to the God and made supplication with incense and wine to your statue, which I had ordered to be brought into the court for the purpose, together with the images of God. And in addition to this, they cursed Christ, none of which things, it is said, those who are really Christians can be made to do. Others who were named by an informer said that they were Christians and soon after denied it, saying indeed that they had been, but had ceased to be Christians some 3 years ago, some many years, and one even 20 years ago. All these also not only worshipped your statue and the images of God, but also cursed Christ. They asserted, however, that the amount of their fault and error was this, that they had been accustomed to assemble on a fixed day before daylight and sing antiphonally a hymn to Christ as a God, and that they bound themselves with an oath not to commit a crime, but to commit neither theft, nor robbery, nor adultery, nor to break their word, nor to deny a deposit when demanded. After these things were done, it was their custom to depart and meet together again to take food, but ordinary and harmless food. And they said that even this had ceased after my edict was issued, by which, according to your commands, I had forbidden the existence of clubs. On this account, I believed it the more necessary to find out from two maidservants who were called deaconesses, and that by torture, what was the truth. I found nothing else than a perverse and excessive superstition. I therefore adjourned the examination and hastened to consult you. The matter seemed to me to be worth deliberation, especially on account of the number of those in danger, for many of every age, every rank, and even of both sexes are brought into danger and will be in the future. The contagion of that superstition has penetrated not only the cities, but also the villages and country places, and yet it seems possible to stop it and set it right. At any rate, it is certain enough that the temple, deserted until quite recently, begin to be frequented, that the ceremonies of religion long disused are restored, and that fodder for the victims comes to market, whereas buyers of it were until now very few. From this it may easily be supposed what a multitude of men can be reclaimed if there be a place for repentance. Now you notice how Pliny says that recently nobody was going hardly to the heathen temple. Nobody was making sacrifices in them. People just weren't interested. Now they're beginning to come. So that it would seem from this that in Bithynia there, in that section of Asia Minor, there had been such a spread of Christianity that great multitudes of people had become Christians. And these, of course, didn't go to the temples, and many others had lost interest in the temples. And it's pretty good evidence that at this time, about 80 years after the death of Christ, Christianity had spread rather widely in that section of Asia Minor. And we have no reason to think that that was not a typical section of the Roman Empire. That is to say, there might be other sections in which it had spread more than there. There might be others in which it had spread far less. But it probably was rather typical. And Pliny felt that if he were to make an all-out effort to destroy Christianity, he could succeed. Many people who had been considered Christians had denied it when they would lose their lives if they continued. People were beginning to go back to the temple. He writes praising. Now he says, you think I could make an all-out effort to destroy Christianity? And one wonders, if Trajan had made an all-out effort to destroy Christianity, humanly speaking, I would say it would have been destroyed. It was a comparatively small movement at that time, even though widespread within the empire. We have no evidence that there was more than, say, 2% of the people at most that were Christians by this time. What does Pliny advise him? Well, we have letter 97 from Trajan to Pliny. And in the course of that letter, he answers Pliny, whom he calls Secundus in the letter. He says, you have followed, my dear Secundus, the proper course of procedure in examining the case of those who were accused to you as Christians. For indeed, nothing can be laid down as a general law which contains anything like a definite rule of action. They are not to be sought out. If they are accused and convicted, they are to be punished. Yet on this condition, that he who denies that he is a Christian and makes the fact evident by an act, that is, by worshiping our God, shall obtain pardon on his repentance, however much suspected as to the past. Papers, however, which are presented anonymously ought not to be admitted in any accusation, for they are a very bad example and unworthy. Now you notice Trajan's attitude. Trajan told Pliny, no, do not have an all-out movement to find out who are Christians and to either execute them or make them turn against them. He says, no. Trajan was not interested in destroying Christianity. But Trajan had an impression that Christianity was something that was illegal and that should not be permitted. He got this tradition as it had been established among the leaders of the empire since Nero and since Domitian. He didn't know how it had become established. He probably had 1,000 various things he was dealing with, trying to be to rule the empire in the best way he could. He faces this problem without giving much time. He says, yes, I understand it's a crime. I understand it's wrong. It's got to be punished. You've executed these who were Christians. Fine, you're doing the right thing. But he says, don't seek them out. Don't make a hunt. Don't try to find them. Don't listen to anonymous papers. Don't even look at them. But he says, if somebody is declared to be a Christian, if they bring charges against somebody that he is, well, bring him before you and ask him. And if he says no, let him worship the gods and dismiss him. And if he says yes, tell him, do you want to be killed or are you willing to give it up? And if he gives it up, forgive him. So you see, Trajan's attitude was one of lack of interest in the whole problem. He felt it was wrong. For some reason, previous emperors had decided this was bad. It must not be permitted to go unchecked. But it is not a pressing danger which deserves investigation and searching out. And Trajan evidently thought that the idea of having people think they can make accusations against other people just when they have grudges and so on was a worse evil than Christianity was. And therefore, he didn't want to do anything to stimulate that. Mr. Hoover? Well, this is a series of quotations by a man named Ayer, A-Y-E-R, which he calls a source book for ancient Greek history. And instead of bringing down a copy of Suetonius and Tacitus and Josephus and Pliny, it's easier to just bring the one. So sometimes it's a bit exasperating because he'll leave out two particular sentences I want to read or maybe start a little further on than I'd like to. But Ayer is a good selection, though there are many things I wish he'd included, didn't. Here's a more convenient one, is Bettinson. Bettinson's Documents of the Christian Church, published by the Oxford Press, is a very convenient little book that has a lot of excellent quotations on Christian and much easier to carry about than this larger book. Well, then you've noticed, number one, the evidences of the spread of Christianity and evidence of the official attitude toward Christianity. And now the next evidence that we have of the early days of Christianity is an extremely interesting one. Capital C, Ignatius. Ignatius. And at about this time, we don't know the exact time, about this time, there were some letters written which have been preserved. In fact, we have several different editions of them which were preserved. And we know very, very little about the man who wrote the letter, either before or after he wrote the letter. And he wrote the letters all in the course of not over a few months. But these letters were thought to be important enough by the Christians that they preserved them and they copied. He wrote these letters to different churches. He wrote one to the Church of Rome, and he wrote them to various churches in the Roman Empire. It's about the same time as when Pliny wrote his letter. But Ignatius wrote letters to different churches, and these letters were copied. They have been preserved in Greek and also in a Latin translation, and these have been copied and recopied. They were largely forgotten during the Middle Ages, but in the beginning of the modern period, copies of them were found in various libraries, manuscripts with these letters of Ignatius. And in the letters, Ignatius describes himself as Bishop of Antioch. And there is one reference elsewhere which says he was the second bishop of Antioch after Peter. Antioch, as you know, or you should know at least, it was the second largest city in the Roman Empire. It was the city where the Christians were, where the followers of Christ were first called Christians. Much is said about it in the book of Acts. It is in Syria, north of Palestine, on the Mediterranean Sea. And now, today, it is in Turkey, in the very most southern part of Turkey. But Ignatius refers to himself as Bishop of Antioch. We have no evidence from ancient times of Ignatius' background, how long he'd been Bishop of Antioch, anything of, that he did before he wrote these letters, and we have not even evidence of what happened to him after the letter. But from the letters, we gather that Ignatius, when he wrote these letters, was on his way to Rome to be cast into the arena and killed because of being a Christian. We learn from these letters that by the time when Ignatius wrote them, the word bishop had come to be used in a different sense from its use in the book of Acts. Because in the book of Acts and in the epistles, bishop and presbyter are used for the same thing. Bishop describes a man's activity. The word means overseer, one who has general direction or oversight. Presbyter means elder. It describes the character of a man you look up to for his experience and for his leadership. And you never in the New Testament speak of the bishop and the elder, but they will speak of one or the other. And they may speak in the same passage, call people bishops one time and call them elders another time in the same passage. So it is quite easily established in the New Testament that bishops and elders were the same thing in the book of Acts. But we learn from Ignatius' writing that the word bishop by that time had come to be used as we would use the term pastor today. It was the name, the overseer, referred to the leader of a congregation. And we can get a pretty good idea from Ignatius' writing, and we get further evidence from other writings soon after, that by this time it had been established that there was one pastor to a town. There might be a city like Antioch, in which there might perhaps be 1,000 Christians, perhaps 10,000. They would have one bishop. There might be a little town of 150 people, which there were 20 Christians, and they had a bishop. Bishop was the pastor of a town. And if you had a large city like Antioch, he would have presbyters under him. And these presbyters, he would assign certain parts of the town, perhaps, but other times they would all meet together. That sort of an organization had become established soon after Ignatius' time, and it seems most likely by Ignatius' time. Now, we have no evidence of what happened between Acts and this time, how it became established. So under capital C, Ignatius, we will look at number one, what we know about him and his writings. What we know about him and his writings. A little less than a century ago, there was a tremendous controversy that raged in the Christian world about Ignatius' letters. We know nothing about him except for his letters and one or two references in Christian history written considerable time afterwards and perhaps simply based on the letters. So we
everything we can learn from him, we have to learn from these letters. And naturally, there were those a century ago who said, well, this is all a fictitious. Somebody made all this up. There never was a man who's naked. Well, after great controversy and heated discussion, scholars pretty well came to an agreement that the letters are genuine. Now, there are some longer forms of the letters, and those may be added to. They may have been extended. But the main letters, there are 13 letters. Out of these, 7 are quite generally accepted as genuine. And these 7 are sometimes in a longer form than shorter form. I doubt if any scholar today would deny that the 7 letters in their shorter form are authentic, come from the pen of Ignatius. Now, some might think much more was genuine. Some might question whether the rest were added letters written by this later or added secondary letters. But the 7 in their shorter form are quite sufficient to learn a good deal about Ignatius and about his time. And I will assign you some readings in them later on. So number one, what we know about him and his writings, it's all from these writings, but they are considered, at least in the shorter form, to be genuine. Now number two is a very, very interesting thing about Ignatius. His idea of martyrdom. Ignatius would seem to have been quite an elderly man at this time. It would seem likely from the way he speaks that he had had a considerable period of time. I don't think we can say maybe 40 years, maybe 10 years, but I would think a considerable portion of time he had been leader of the Church of Antioch. And he was highly respected as a leader of Christians in that area. But now he feels that he wants to have a very great, wonderful thing happen, to die for the cause of Christ. And so he has an attitude toward martyrdom that we do not commonly find among Christian people. And so now he writes to the Church of Rome. And he says to them, I write to all the churches and impress on all that I shall willingly die for God unless ye hinder me. In other words, he's afraid of his life, that somebody in the Church of Rome will have some influence with the emperor to get him spared. And he wants to die as a martyr. So he says, unless you hinder me, I beseech you not to show unseasonable goodwill towards me. Permit me to be the food of wild beasts to whom it will be granted me to attain unto God. I am the wheat of God, and I am ground by the teeth of wild beasts, that I may be found the pure bread of Christ. Rather entice the wild beasts, that they may become my tomb and leave nothing of my body, so that when I have fallen asleep, I may be burdensome to no one. Then I shall be truly a disciple of Jesus Christ, when the world sees not my body. Entreat Christ for me, that by these instruments I may be found a sacrifice to God. Not as Peter and Paul do I issue commandments unto you. They were apostles, I a condemned man. They were free, I even until now a slave. But if I suffer, I shall be the freedman of Jesus Christ and shall rise again free in him. Now that's a very strong statement. There are others in his letters showing that at this time he had what some would think was an almost morbid desire to be killed for the sake of Christ. And so he had been arrested by the Romans in Antioch, accused of being a Christian under this law of Trajan, that if a person is accused, a person is given a chance to deny it and be released, to give evidence that it's not true by worshiping the God. He admits it, but he, evidently being a person of standing, is not killed there. He's ordered to be sent to Rome, there to die in the arena. And so, on his way to Rome, he is permitted to greet the Christians in all the various towns as he goes through. And he writes these letters which he sends to different churches, exhorting them to follow the Lord and not to be scared by the persecution, not to turn away, but to be true to Christ and to put him first in everything. And so his idea that it is a wonderful thing to have a chance to die as a martyr to Christ is something we do not find in the New Testament. We find in the New Testament that if that comes to one, he should rejoice that God chooses to give him a chance to prove that he can be true to the death. But we don't find in the New Testament any evidence that it is desirable that we shall seek to be killed or tortured for the cause of Christ. So there is what seems to us today almost a morbid attitude, but certainly facing torture, facing execution, people are apt to go to one or extreme or the other. and from the extreme of many who deny the faith, or who find some excuse to get away from it, and we find later on that there were Christians who would get a forged paper certifying that they had sacrificed, when they hadn't sacrificed to idols, but they got a paper certifying they had, and they'd show that to try to escape punishment. Certainly the attitude of Ignatius is far preferable to that. And so we find of two extremes, he went to the better of the two extremes, but certainly nothing that the New Testament commands. But number three is his idea of the place of a bishop, and that is very interesting. Ignatius, we find in his letters, in the first place, he does not consider that a bishop is a successor of the apostles. You notice he said, not like Peter and Paul do I issue commandments. The Roman Catholic Church maintains that the apostles appointed successors, and they appointed successors, and thus we get the bishops today. In fact, the Episcopal Church holds a somewhat similar view. They lay great stress on what they call apostolic successors. We find no evidence of this in Ignatius. We find no claim from him. I have this position because hands were put on me, if somebody had hands put on him, so on back to one of the apostles. We find him explicit here, saying, I don't have the right like Peter and Paul, the apostles of the Lord, to lay commandments upon you. He says, no, I'm not in the class with that. I'm not an apostle. I'm simply a bishop. But he does hold that the bishop has very great authority over the people. And next Wednesday, we will look at his precise statement as to the position of the bishop.